Supreme Court. It invites students from around the state to come to a oral argument. If the students wish to come, they are given copies of the brief of the case that they would be hearing, and they might do some outside activities with that case. And then the procedure is that a member of this court, and it varies from time to time or day to day, meets with the students to discuss the procedures of the case, not the substance or the substantive issue of the case. Everybody's invited to attend that session. All right. And so let me introduce the court to you all. We sit with a new member this September. And I'll start with him. And on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Pat Patience Robinsack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her right, Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. They haven't arrived yet. I've spent as much time to avoid disturbance as I can, so I'll call the first case this morning, 07AP46, D.L. Anderson's Lakeside Leisure Company, Inc. versus Donald Anderson, representing D.L. Anderson's Lakeside Leisure Company, and the stats is his attorney, Palmersheim. You may proceed.
Please the court. My name is Kevin Palmersheim, and I'm arguing on behalf of the Statzes and D.L. Anderson's Lakeside Leisure on the trade name and breach of non-compete claims. This case is essentially about whether Wisconsin will protect the value of a business name. In a business context, you can steal inventory, you can smash windows, those items can be replaced. But once you take someone's name, that injury persists. Now, the principal issue I want to address is trade name damages. That's the principal argument on this appeal. The jury found not only liability on the trade name infringement in this case, but also imposed $75,000 in compensatory damages and $180,000 in punitive damages. The jury was instructed without objection, quote, "You may determine what sum of money will right the wrong done to the plaintiffs by the defendants." That is the standard for tort damages in Wisconsin. That represents the broad evidence rule, the broad scope that Wisconsin courts use to address damages. Now, often this court will ask counsel, if I were to write the majority opinion, how would I write it? In the context of trade name infringement, a trade name is synonymous with goodwill and reputation. It represents an exclusive right. An infringer takes away that exclusive right and presumptively injures the owner when it starts using an infringing name. This is consistent not only with trade name cases around the country, such as Beefeater, the James Burrow case, which talked about the use of the sign of the Beefeater name in connection with the restaurant, but it's also consistent with Wisconsin case law in situations like defamation. In defamation, in a business context, it's considered slander per se. And the presumption is when someone makes a false statement that is related to a business or profession, the injury to the reputation is presumed.
Counsel, isn't the concern here that the jury had to speculate that while the jury knew that the figure was $200,000 for goodwill, that when you got to this idea of trade name infringement, that there really was no evidence from which they could arrive at, I think, the figure of $75,000. So isn't the concern that there was speculation here because there was no real evidence that got them to that $75,000 figure?
Well, Justice, I think that is the argument that the defendants make. And I think we have to analyze this in terms of the fact of damages and then the measure of damages. And in order to prove the fact of damages, you have to prove that it's either presumptively an injury, such as defamation or use use of an infringing mark. In the amount of damages, the tort standard is to provide the jury with a measuring stick. And the measuring stick in this case was the $200,000. Let us assume that the jury in this case awarded $200,000. Then the question is the evidence supportive of that jury verdict? If a trade name represents an exclusive right, and the value of that exclusive right, which is undisputed, and which was set by a price between the infringer and the owner of the mark at $200,000, that is supportive. The jury could reasonably conclude that $200,000 represents the damage. Now, what the jury did in this case is what we ask juries to do all the time. They analyzed the evidence, and they didn't award plaintiffs what we wanted. They didn't award the defendants what the defendants wanted. They took that measuring stick, and they assessed what a reasonable amount of damages would be. They
was there any testimony, for instance, that, you know, we paid $200,000 for goodwill, and we lost about 30% of our goodwill because of all this confusion that's been going on? Was there anything like that during the course of the testimony?
There was testimony in terms of the injury to the goodwill, in terms of the confusion and the fact of injury. And then there was also testimony by both Scott and Steve Statz. Scott Statz testified that if he would have not gotten that name, he would not have paid that $200,000. That's on page 174 of the transcript. Steve Statz testified he wouldn't have paid as much for the name. So their testimony is similar to when you look at the Forrester Labs case, where the plaintiff in that case testified they should get $180,000 in damages, and the defendant said it should be $5,000, and the court set it at $75,000. Or if you look at the Dolger case, for example, which dealt with the damage to property in a fire, in that particular case, the testimony was that the property had a replacement value. However, the property hadn't been used in 10 years, and it was 30 years old. In that case, the trier fact, which was the judge in that case, was able to determine the diminution in value or depreciation and the obsolescence of that property without any other evidence. So this is the standard, Judge. And I understand, or Justice, I understand the difficulty, but we provide measuring sticks in tort cases all the time to the jury. And what we also say is when the degree of conduct by the infringer contributes to the difficulty in calculating these damages, we still hold the infringer responsible. The Eden Court mentioned that, and that was the Stone Quarry case. And it was difficult to apportion damages and to value damages. And even though that it was difficult, part of that difficulty was because the defendants in that case were the ones that stole the property. It couldn't be valued easily. And we allow that type of flexibility to take place.
Also, what troubles me is I don't know from what I've seen, and I haven't read all of the record, why 75 is appropriate rather than 95 or 100 or 110 or 25. That's kind of what troubles me. Not that you haven't proved the fact of damages, but the amount. I can't understand quite how they chose that particular amount. Can you explain that a little bit more?
In terms of how we don't have to track, in the case of Savis, track how they arrived at the amount. We have to track whether they're within the range of reason here. How they got to that amount could be based on the value of the name, and there was $200,000 value of the name. It had been fringed over a period of years by the time that we got to trial. The case was filed in 04. The infringement started when Anderson Marine was started in 03, went to trial in 06. If you use an apportionment in terms of the number of years and also the testimony of the defendants indicating that they were changing the name, the jury could have said, well, that reputation was $200,000, and that would be if it went on for infinity, but because it was for a limited period of time, we're going to apportion that based on the number of years of infringement. Could have been on a number of reasons that the jury came up with the 75. Most likely it was that they were analyzing it, and they, using their best judgment and on the circumstances of the case, believed that $75,000 would compensate for the wrong that was done.
That's about one-third the value of the goodwill.
That's right. And this is what's difficult in terms of valuing goodwill, Chief, is that it's an exclusive right. And I pointed this out in the brief. Intangible property, either have the property or you don't. But an intangible property like goodwill or a trade name, even though my clients are left with the name, the value of that name has been taken. You know, the exclusive right is gone. We argued that it should be the whole $200,000. We didn't get the whole $200,000. But that still is the range of evidence. Now, Justice Robinsack, your question, I think, would be a very good one if we had a jury verdict where they assessed $250,000 in damages or something over that. Then the evidence wouldn't support that because it would be outside that range.
Another problem I have is that I don't, you know, as I read the arguments that were made in the briefs, perhaps more by your opponents than by you, it seems they were thinking you had to show there was a diminution in the value of the goodwill. And to me, this is a little bit more like the infringement of a patent where you don't have a license and you just go ahead and use it. You're the inventor and you sell your patent to Sam Smith, but then as Mr. Inventor, you go ahead and use that technology without a license. It doesn't make the invention worth less, but you've taken something without paying for it. Do you understand what I mean?
Yes, and I think if you look at the Sands Court or the Forrester Courts, they impose the reasonable royalty method of damages, yeah. And I think that kind of addresses what you're talking about there, is what would be a reasonable royalty.
Well, if you were looking at the evidence in that regard, what would you tell me would be in the record that would support that?
In terms of the diminution of value...
the reasonable royalty kind of approach. Is there anything in there that would support that?
We didn't make arguments based on a reasonable royalty.
Okay.
I think maybe another way, counsel, of asking that, at least how I would put it, is there anything else besides the fact of the $200,000 payment for the goodwill, so to speak, and also the testimony of Mr. Statz in regard to the fact that they would have paid something less for that goodwill if they knew what was going to happen? Is there anything else in the record to support the $75,000 number?
Well, in terms of monetary evidence in the record, there is evidence concerning sales of particular items going down and the profits related to those items going down. We didn't pursue a lost profits, but if you look at the Ryman Court analysis, the evidence of sales can help support those damages. There was competition between these two businesses. There were some overlapping products in what we call towables or water toys and also in moorings. And if you look at before Anderson Marine was set up, towables or toys, for example, was $20,000, and that dropped down to about $5,000.
And how do you link that fact to the confusion?
Well, that's the difficulty, and that's why we didn't try to approach this as a lost profits, is how do we apportion the lost profits between the wrong done by infringing the trade name and the wrong done by breaching the non-compete? And when we analyzed this as a plaintiff's counsel, we thought no number of experts are going to be able to apportion this, at least at any sort of non-cost prohibitive nature. It just, the nature of the wrong was so pervasive that we couldn't apportion it that way. But we didn't need to. You know, if you look at lost profits...
Couldn't one of the owners have testified, gee, based upon my knowledge and experience and observations of this business, I think this has cost us X number of dollars. And if they could have, why didn't they?
I think they did when they testified that they thought that value was zero, that they would not have paid that $200,000 if because of that infringement.
But that's different from saying zero. They wouldn't have paid $200,000. What would they have paid?
Scott Stass testified he would have paid zero. He wouldn't have paid anything.
Where in the record do you see that? I'm sorry, did I interrupt you?
174 of the transcript, Scott Stass's testimony. Steve Stass testified that he wouldn't have paid as much, and that was on page 316 of the transcript.
I read Steve's. You said not as paid as much, and you said Scott said you would have paid zero.
Yep.
It makes it worthless. That's your point.
That's the point.
What do you do with regard to this lack of specific amount? All of us have grown up, and some of us are grown, let's say, in auto accident cases, plain run-of-the-mill auto accident case. Pain and suffering, right? What sum of money will fairly and reasonably compensate the plaintiff for, A, you know, past pain and suffering? And there's no need for anyone to testify that my pain and suffering is worth $60,000 in order to sustain a jury finding of $60,000 for past pain and suffering. That's kind of an intangible. So I'm used to that. You know, I know the jury instruction. The jury is not to speculate, right?
Right.
On the other hand, the interpretation of jury instructions in cases where it's where there is difficult, intangible things, the jury in case law says that the jury is to come up with a fair and reasonable approximation of the damages. That's how they interpret in case law. What does reasonable certainty mean? Well, the cases say reasonable certainty means a fair and reasonable approximation. You know, so, but what correlation is there between something like pain and suffering, something like defamation, loss of my good name, and the need to have actual testimony regarding the amount of the loss of the diminution of value in trade cases, trademark cases?
Well, I think the defamation cases provide the perfect analogy because you're talking about reputation. And if you look at, for example, the Teff case, which involves the chiropractors, in that case, the jury assessed $10,000 in damages in favor of each of the two plaintiffs for reputation, damage to reputation. But the testimony, the only testimony in that case was of patients that said, my opinion of these chiropractors didn't lower at all. They were good people. There was no evidence. In fact, the evidence was the opposite. But what the court said is that because of the comments, the verbal statements that were made, impugning the morality or reputation of these chiropractors, it was reasonable for them to be concerned. They had made a business investment. Same thing with the Badger Bearings case, Judge. In that case, a former employee starts a new business, and the former employer sends a letter out saying that this conduct is illegal and immoral. The jury imposes $15,000 in damages for defamation, diminution of reputation. In that case, the court says it is reasonable for that letter, even though there's no evidence that the reputation actually diminished, for that letter and the comments on the reputation to have affected that individual, because we're talking about reputation. And in a trade name case, for a business, that is reputation.
Okay, what's the evidence of the diminution of reputation in this case, then?
Then you're talking about the evidence of the actual, similar to actual confusion for likelihood of confusion. Sue Statz testified at length concerning the number of customers and vendors and people that they had problems with. For example, one customer by the name of Walter Meanwell, a customer of Anderson Marine, or customer of D.L. Anderson Co., Sue Statz was contacting him because he hadn't paid his invoice. And he says, well, I've written you a check a number of times. Well, he wrote the check out to Anderson Marine and sent it to Anderson Marine. And when he was irritated. He was unhappy. Why do you guys keep bothering me with invoices? Another client, Todd Popkovitz, I think is his name. It's in the briefs. Also had a problem with the invoices. The vendors, Carla Statz and Stunts, who's no relation to the Statzes, they had numerous problems because their invoices as a vendor were not getting paid. And they were calling, there was calling on the Statzes to say, why isn't this invoice being paid? Well, that is the type of evidence. That is your reputation, Judge, when you're talking about business, your good name. And if once you lose that good name, you are injured.
Well, are you relying on the fact that the jury has to make an inference that for the few instances that are given in evidence that there must be more?
Yes, and the Statz has testified that there were many more, that there were, they kept logs, and that there were over 100, I believe, instances like this. Now, some of them couldn't be introduced into evidence because of hearsay issues, but the testimony was not what they said, but the fact that this was causing a problem. And staff time for the Statzes was being used to address that and deal with that.
You have, I think, six issues in this case. As far as I can tell, we've dealt with one, which is the compensatory damages under the contract.
Yes, yes, Judge, Justice.
What do you want to say about the other five, if anything? And I assume you're standing on your briefs on those.
Yes.
Okay. Well, isn't there an issue that $75,000 is too much?
That it is too much?
Yeah, I mean, isn't that the issue, and that this should be remitted, or it should be reduced to zero?
But this, if you look at the way we treat tort damages, it's within the range, and I don't believe it is too much.
All right. And if this court does this court decide what the remitter amount should be? That is, how much is reasonable?
I think that the court could decide on, they would have to remand for what is reasonable based on the evidence and give instruction. The court can do that. I think that Jacobs' case talks about that. In that case, it was remanded for nominal damages, but the Supreme Court has the authority to do that and to establish that damages will be set in an amount not to exceed whatever amount the court deems reasonable. I think this court has that power, yes.
If the court decides that the damages are too high, would it send it back for just compensatory damage trial? If you didn't want to accept what the court did.
This court could do that, correct. And if it imposed compensatory damages or left that issue open, then it would have to still address, I think, the punitive damages issue.
Okay.
Is there any actual expenditures incurred because of the alleged trade name infringement?
Well, the expenditures were, in terms of the investigation and the costs, of course, the attorney fees that had to be invested in that. It was difficult to value that or put that in the context of the lost profits or the financial statement analysis. And we chose not to do that directly because it was cost prohibitive to do that. And I know the concern, because this is the reason why I asked this court to hear this case, is because all of us as legal professionals are so used to the lost profits analysis and the way we analyze damages, and Justice Bradley, how your concept in the terms of the pain and suffering. But here we had a perfect valuation method, a measuring stick, because both parties set the value of this name that was taken. Now, I understand the concern about the amount, but again, I go back to, if this jury had awarded $200,000 in damages, would that be supported by the record? Because the jury is the fact finder. They're the ones that weigh the evidence in this case. And if that name is worth $200,000 and it represents an exclusive right, and it represents the reputation, once it was taken, that would support damages. What we're struggling with here is because the jury awarded less than that. But that's what a jury's function is.
Counsel, what's your best argument if we decide that damages were proved but you didn't have proof of the amount of damages in regard to whether we should include nominal damages as a matter of course when damages are proved but the amount is not solid enough to be accepted? What's your best argument?
Well, the nominal damages are assessed when there's an intentional infringement of a known legal right, and it's used to vindicate that right. And it's appropriate in trademark cases, as I've indicated with the Supreme Court and Seventh Circuit, talking about that. And this court has remanded and set nominal damages in other cases where we're talking about a known legal right that's been infringed. So this court would be empowered to state that the fact of infringement was found. That's supported by the evidence. If there were no compensatory damages supported by the evidence and the amount we claim, then it should be remanded with no more than $1 nominal damages imposed.
Isn't the nominal damages award case law rather sparse? My recollection is that the Steinberg case is the case from several years ago, and that was a very outrageous situation. Do you think you have to have an outrageous situation before the court would award nominal damages?
Well, I think that are you talking about the punitive component of that or the nominal?
Well, they go hand in hand. You can't get the punitive unless you get the nominal, or unless we say $75,000 or something closely akin was okay. So your $180,000 in punitive damages is tied directly to your argument on there could be nominal damages.
I think that the way you analyze that is if you look at the Hirsch court, which talked about Crazy Legs Hirsch and valuing his name, and they cited, the court cited Dean Prosser's analysis of the four privacy rights, invasion of privacy, and one was the intrusion upon a plaintiff's seclusion, One was public disclosure of embarrassing private facts. One was public publicity, which paints the plaintiff in a false light. And the fourth was appropriation of a plaintiff's name or likeness. Wisconsin only recognizes common law claims in two of those situations. One is intrusion upon a plaintiff's seclusion only when it's a property right, trespass. And Wisconsin recognizes infringement of a trade name. Those situations involve not only an invasion of privacy, invasion into somebody's seclusion, but also combined with a strong property right. And that's what we have here, both with the trespass case and with the trade name case, that there is a property right. And also, they're combined with the situation where actual damages, the amount of damages, are difficult and often impossible to establish. Now, because of the important property right and the important privacy right, this court has determined that a deterrence effect is necessary and needed. And I believe the analogy between those two is very close. The other thing that I think is important, Justice Crooks, is the Jack case, the Steinberg Homes case. We weren't talking about the invasion of their home or the invasion of their personal space. This is a 170-acre farm. They couldn't even see where the trespass was occurring from their home. But this court viewed that property right as important enough to allow deterrence, to imposition of nominal damages, and also punitive damages.
Well, but in that particular case, if I remember correctly, there was a request, can we come across your land? And the answer was no, absolutely not. They went anyway. And that seems to me a little more outrageous than what allegedly occurred here.
Well, the egregiousness, I think, exists in this case, too. The trial court, the trial judge, after trial at a motion hearing, commented that every time a line was drawn in the sand, she was addressing this to Don Anderson, who was in the court, you walked up to it and crossed over it. And she said repeatedly, I don't know what I have to do here to make the message clear. I don't know how I'm going to write this opinion. But the jury did not believe you, and that disbelief was palpable, and that's the word she used. So that type of egregious conduct existed. I see my time is up. I'll save my rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Van Sicklen, I have you down for 20 minutes, and I have Ms. Is it Wild or Wildy or Wildy?
It's Bree Grassi Wildy.
Wildy, okay. For 10 minutes, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
We may shift it depending on the questions, but we'll do our best to allocate according to our letter to the court.
In other words, you might usurp the whole 20.
That won't be my purpose.
I get it.
Good morning. May it please the court. As you know, I'm Mike Van Sicklen. I am going to split my argument with my colleague, Ms. Wildy. I'd be remiss, I guess, in not prefacing my remarks by not noting that this case was the last appellate argument that Dan Hildebrand handled, and it's with a mixture of sorrow and honor, I guess, that we picked up the case midstream for Dan after his untimely demise. And kind of with that awkward transition, I want to focus on what we believe is the seminal issue in this case. We believe you don't get to the issue of the tort damages or the punitive damages or any of that because this entire case was driven by a fundamental faulty legal premise by the statses and the trial court on the tort claim. This tort claim drove the case. It should have been a breach of contract case. And what drove it was their contention, which over Anderson's vigorous objection, the trial court accepted and implemented, that once a person sells his business in an asset purchase agreement and includes the sale of the trade name, and that trade name includes his or her personal name, here Anderson, D.L. Anderson, that person is forever, in perpetuity, precluded from ever using his name in another business, regardless of whether it competes or not. And we think that that one is clearly not the law in Wisconsin. It's clearly not the law in any of the trade name treatises we've cited, McCarthy, Callan, etc. And secondly, it ignores the contract here. This case should have been decided and driven by the contract. And what I'd like to do is talk briefly about the legal rules, talk about why the contract should and does control here, why there wasn't any competition, and why the Court of Appeals made a mistake on the waiver. It wasn't waived. And then talk about why our position comports with Wisconsin's public policy. Now, the legal rules we submit are very clear on this trade name. The law in Wisconsin and everywhere in the country is that when you sell your name, your personal name as part of the trade name here, you retain the right to use your name in another business, competing or otherwise, unless and only to the extent that you expressly and unequivocally sell all rights to use that name. And the law that we cite in page 2 of our reply brief, McCarthy, Callan on trademarks, etc., makes clear that a court may not engage in the presumption that the statutes urge that, well, if it's not clear what you've retained, then you've lost it. If you just sell the name, there's a presumption that you intended to sell the exclusive right to use the name. If this was a trade name that was Acme, you know, Pure and Voice, we wouldn't have this issue, but every single case and treatise makes clear it's different where the trade name involves your personal name. And that's what we have here. Now, we submit that the contract should govern. They say there's really two contractual undertakings and they're separate somehow, but that's just not the case. At section 2.1 of the asset purchase agreement, it says, that's the provision they point to, it says, you know, that Anderson is selling inventory, equipment, various things, including the trade name and goodwill. It's prefaced, 2.1, with subject to the terms and conditions elsewhere in this contract. 3.4 is also prefaced, saying, except as otherwise provided in the contract. Now you get to 6.5. They would read that provision right out of the contract. 6.5 very clearly says that Anderson cannot open up a new business with his last name Anderson that competes for 7 years. Okay? It doesn't say that he can't open up any new non-competing business
within 7 years.
Okay, the purchase agreement is in our appendix at page 143, 6.5. It says, seller and Anderson covenant and agree for a period of 7 years, they will neither permit Anderson's name to be used by nor engage in, directly or indirectly, in the end of it, any business in competition with the Pure and Lip business.
Okay. Well, was the new business of Mr. Anderson in competition with the Pure and Lip business?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And I point to six things that make that clear. They are, if you look at the Court of Appeals, footnote 12, page 22 of their decision, they expressly found, I don't know if it was an oral argument or the briefs and record, that the statutes have never claimed there was competition by the boathouse at Anderson Marine. Secondly,
what did the jury find?
The jury wasn't asked to decide that. That's the seminal mistake in this case. I'll get to the jury instruction in the closing argument. But the Statzes admitted expressly in their trial testimony, both Steve Statz and Scott Statz, if you look at our appendix, at pages 152 to 155, there's no way to read their testimony as not being an explicit admission of no competition. Additionally, their entire Supreme Court brief doesn't claim competition. They argue, we didn't need to show competition. All we had to show was confusion. That's wrong, we submit. Now, interestingly, the Statz has also testified that, in fact, the boathouse complemented and assisted their Pure and Hoist business because every time Anderson sold a boat, there was another more of a need for a Pure or a Hoist. They were complementary, not conflicting businesses. Additionally, the Statzes were part owners of the boathouse. They were involved in the sale.
Let me interrupt you, if I might. Yeah. As I went back and looked at my notes, and your opposing counsel said there was some product competition here. Now, is your argument there was no competition as to product, or that there was no competition in regard to peers and lifts?
There was no competition of anything that was sold as part of the D.L. Anderson business, and there's no way to read the Statz's testimony differently. There is a remark, the one kind of red herring in this thing is the Court of Appeals at paragraph 16 of the decision made that in the section about the trade name where they dropped the footnote and said there's no competition. The Court of Appeals made this remark about buoys. Well, as we laid out in our brief with the citations, as we all know, if you're a boater, there's really two kinds of buoys going on here. There's the kind of buoys that D.L. Anderson sold, which is a 1,200-pound anchored steel-cabled mooring buoy that you put out, you know, with your boat. And at the top, it has something that floats. That's not something the boathouse ever sold. And the testimony in the record is clear. And even if there was some overlap of, you know, they sold $100 worth of buoys left over in inventory or the like, and there's no evidence about whether the boathouse ever sold some buoy, but it was just incidental. The case law we cite makes clear that to have competition for purposes of involving or invoking this provision, it's got to be real competition. They've admitted in their testimony that there was no direct competition.
Counsel, why, and you point to 6.5 non-competition in the language therein and sub A with regard to any business in competition, etc. But your opposing counsel would advance the argument, hey, we have separate causes of action here. Duty to non-compete, to fulfill the non-compete clause set forth in the asset purchase agreement, and also the infringement of trade name. And that's a infringement of trade name is a common law cause of action and follows the common law except to the extent it's modified by contract. But you're pointing to the, it seems to me that you're pointing to the non-compete covenant and using the language there to diminish the infringement of the trade name here. Why aren't they separate?
Because the law, common law governing trade names is very clear, like we've laid out at pages 17 to 18 of our brief, that where you're selling as part of the trade name, your last name, D.L. Anderson, unless it's expressly made clear that the conveyance of the trade name includes the exclusive right for the buyer to forever have the name, that the seller retains under common law, under every case in the country or every trademark treatise that's ever looked at it, you retain the right to use your name in another business, even if it competed. Now,
What about 6.4, Mr. Van Sifflin, which says, as of the closing date, seller. That's Mr. Anderson.
And that's the key. No, it's not. If you look at the beginning of the contract, the seller is D.L. Anderson, the business.
But it says, agrees not to use the name D.L. Anderson or any variation thereof. Seller shall amend its articles of incorporation to change its company name made necessary filing. I read that as saying, don't use D.L. Anderson or Donald Anderson in any other business that smells like, looks like, or is adjacent to.
And the reason the stances have never argued that, and it's clear in the conversations in the jury instruction discussions that are at the last 20 pages of our appendix. The reason is that when you look at the beginning of the contract, there's defined terms of what seller, capital S, is, as used in 6.4, and Mr. Mm-hmm. Anderson. Seller was D.L. Anderson, the entity they bought. It did not go out and buy the boathouse or run the boathouse. Mr. Anderson, under an unrelated in his own name, did, and that's why the difference in 6.5. 6.5 says that Mr. Anderson may not use the name in a new business that competes for 7 years. They wouldn't have defined it so carefully. And if I may get to the waiver argument, the Court of Appeals said, well, you've waived this argument, Anderson. Might be an interesting argument. But I think what happened with Judge Bergeron there, in fairness to her, is that when we raised the argument, when Mr. Hildebrand did in his Court of Appeals brief at pages 18 through 21, the Stasis did not argue waiver. So we, on reply, never had any reason to point the Court of Appeals to all the places where we clearly preserved this objection. It was in our answer affirmative defenses. We moved for summary judgment. We moved for a directed verdict. 20 pages of over 2 days on the jury instructions, the last 20 pages of our appendix, every single page in there, Mr. Palmerschein, the trial counsel for Anderson, raised this issue. Motions after verdict, if you look at record 72, at page 2 of our brief, it was raised. Now, so it wasn't waived, and it's clearly the wrong jury instruction. If you look at the instruction the trial court gave, record 103, transcript 855, she said that to prevail, the Statzes only had to show confusion. They didn't have to show that there was any competition by the boathouse. And then the prejudice here was severe. If you look at the closing arguments that were transcribed in this case, Mr. Palmerschein drove the point home. At transcript, this is record 103, at transcript pages 812 to 813, he said, the question is whether the name he chose creates a likelihood of confusion. Plaintiffs and defendants do not have to be in direct competition in order for you to find infringement. They don't have to be in direct competition. They don't have to have any overlap at all in their business for there to be a violation under the law of the trade name. All that's required is that, one, my clients have established secondary meaning, and two, there's confusion. It was essentially, when you look at the jury instruction conferences and the discussion on our motion for directed verdict, she essentially directed the verdict for them because we admitted the name D.L. Anderson has some value. We sold it. And we admitted that the mailman and the Federal Express guy was confused. They chose to run the business out of Don Anderson's house after they bought it. Not surprising, the mail got confused for a bit. But what they never showed was that they were harmed in any way by Mr. Anderson using his name in a non-competing business. You would be the only court in the country, I submit, that would hold that when you sell the name without an express, explicit conveyance of forever not using your name, that you're precluded from using it in a non-competing business.
We accepted your argument that it's not under the contract and that it's not under the trademark. That takes care of all the issues, doesn't it?
Well, yes and no. It takes care of all three of the issues that the Statzes have raised in their petition. It does not take care of...
Is that compensatory under the contract?
And Ms. Wilde is going to address the $15,000 contract damages, which are important to us because it's the only hook by which they could claim any entitlement to attorney fees or any kind of injunctive relief. One last thing on the public policy I'd note is that...
It seems to me that your argument is confusing commercial use with use as a trade name. Can you respond to that?
I don't think at all. Every single case we cite on this issue of when you sell your own name as a trade name deals with this issue that the law of public policy favors allowing people to compete and run businesses. And it's not a, this is not, they make an interesting comment in their brief. When I point to the Wisconsin law that supports our position, A.W. Thompson, the Statzes in their brief say, yeah, but that's dated law. And then they cite a provision of McCarthy on trade names. That deals with how you perfect a trademark. It's the wrong section on when the sale of the name is in an asset purchase agreement. This is a contract. This reminds me very much of your recent case just a few weeks ago you decided, the very end of the last term, on the residential real estate contract. Why are we engaging in a tort analysis when you have a contract that defines what we can and can't do? We admit we couldn't run a competing business that harmed them. We didn't. That's all we sold them for 7 years. He's claiming Mr. Anderson can't run a business with his name forever. He didn't sell that. In Spiros, they put a lot of weight on, both sides talked about this court's decision in Spiros. If you look at the language of the contract in Spiros, which is at 157 with second 305, there the seller was very explicit. They expressly sold every exclusive right to use the name or any variation in any business competing or not competing. We didn't do that here. So, with with that, I'd like to reserve exactly my 10 minutes for my comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hansick and Ms. Wilde.
Morning. My name is Bree Grossi-Wilde, and I'll be addressing the three damages issues, and I'll go ahead and start with the trademark infringement damages. We agree, as the Court of Appeals explained, that damage to goodwill can be a basis for awarding trade name infringement damages. But here, the statutes have failed to prove both the fact of damage, namely that they were harmed or their goodwill was harmed by this confusion, and have also failed to provide evidence with which the jury could calculate how they should reduce or how they should think about this reduction in the value of the goodwill.
Why isn't the infringement the harm?
Well, here, the evidence that they put forward of infringement is primarily Sue Statz's testimony about confusion. But the problem with relying on confusion to say that there is necessarily an injury based on that confusion is you can imagine a situation where confusion could actually benefit the company that has their trade name infringed upon.
What do you have to show in order to show an infringement under the law in the state of Wisconsin?
In order to show, well, it depends which theory we're going under. If we were going under...
What did the court instruct that the law was in the state of Wisconsin, and the Court of Appeals indicate the law was in the state of Wisconsin to show infringement?
So infringement, it would be a secondary meaning and likelihood of confusion. That would allow you to receive injunctive relief, but wouldn't get you to monetary damages.
So if you... show secondary meaning, that the name has acquired a secondary meaning, and that there's a likelihood of confusion, then you have established infringement under the law. Is that correct or incorrect?
Under trade name infringement law in Wisconsin, yes, but as my colleague explained, we do not believe that's the correct test in this particular case.
So why isn't, I return to my question, why isn't infringement the harm, or as the jury instruction says, the wrong? I'm not saying it's compensable. You know, I mean, you can have injury and then say what sum of money will fairly and reasonably compensate for the injury, and you could end it up with zero. There's a distinction between what sum of money will fairly and reasonably compensate and the injury itself. I return to my question, why isn't infringement the harm?
The only evidence that the stats has put forward of injury is this confusion. And I'll return to my example that there are certainly instances, for example, where the infringing company's reputation is actually better than the company with a trade name that was allegedly infringed. And in that situation, the confusion would actually benefit the company with
it. Wouldn't you still have an infringement then, but you're talking about damages? In other words, let's say... I have a lousy reputation, and for some reason, God knows why, they confuse Justice Prosser, who has a great reputation, right? So there's still, I might benefit from that, so I would have no damages, but that doesn't negate the fact. I'm not completing the analogy because I can't do it, for a variety of reasons. But that doesn't negate the fact of infringement. It just influences what sum of money will fairly and reasonably compensate for the infringement. And if I gain, then there's going to be no compensable injury.
But in that situation, I believe that the theory underlying an injunction is then to protect the public from not confusing Justice Prosser with yourself. And that would be the reason, that would be the harm to the public. But in order to get to damages, the staffs have to show some harm to their own goodwill. And that's where we argue that they haven't connected this evidence of confusion to an actual injury, that they needed some testimony, and we posit perhaps this could have been done in a survey to suggest that the confusion actually translated into their customer base or some other sort of, other population thinking, more poorly of the reputation of the company, and that would then translate into some measurable harm that could then be used, this evidence could be used by the jury then to calculate damages. But even, Justice Bradley, if you assume that there is some injury, that there is harm, that this evidence of confusion gives rise to an inference of harm or infringement of a right, right? Sure, there is injury. There is a fact of damage established. You still have to prove the amount of damage. And this is the only evidence that the stats has put forward to prove the amount of damages is the upward boundary, is this price that they paid. And mind you, this price was for goodwill, which encompasses a lot more than just reputation.
If I may, I found interesting the argument of your opposing counsel that was, hey, look, if the jury had written in $200,000, then we wouldn't be here because there's evidence that both parties agreed in the asset purchase agreement that the value of the goodwill was $200,000, and then you give our standard of review any credible, you know, any evidence that sustained the jury verdict. Can you respond to that, please?
We would still argue that jury verdict was not supported by credible evidence, that the stats has failed to present evidence to the jury that the alleged infringement on the part of Don Anderson completely destroyed their reputation. I mean, that would have to be the conclusion. And beyond the fact that they failed to present evidence that there was actually harm, the testimony was Sue Stats testifying about the confusion that she heard from others. There was no testimony from customers, from vendors, from people that were actually talking about how the confusion translated into damage on the reputation.
Counsel, when I look at the jury instructions here, it looks like the judge basically gave breach of contract instructions. And then when it came to the part regarding damages, there really isn't, when answering 6A, do this, when answering 6B, do this, and separating out what you're going to consider for one part of damages and what you're going to consider for the other. But in any event, what they're instructed is that the party who is injured should, as far as possible, be placed in the position in which he or she would have been had the contract been performed. Now, it's almost like the opposite is being argued here. It's like, if we didn't enter into the contract, we wouldn't have paid $200,000, and therefore we deserve that rebate or that money back. That's not what the jury was instructed. So I'm trying to reconcile what the jury was instructed and how they reached the verdict that they did.
We are trying to reconcile that, too. And it's not clear from the evidence how they determined that $75,000 would be the value associated with, or the decrease in value associated with, the decrease of goodwill. With my time remaining, I thought it would be a good idea to switch to the contract damages. And the issue with the contract damages is the same issue with the amount of damages in the trade name infringement damages, is that they fail to provide credible evidence either on the lost profits theory of actual loss in profits or on the benefit of the bargain damages theory of some decrease in the value, such that the price that they paid is not representative of the actual value of D.L. Anderson. And importantly, this is measured at the time of the sale.
Let me just see. The first question was, has Don Anderson breached the asset purchase agreement with respect to the name, non-competition? That's a contract issue, right? The court answered yes. Do you agree with that? Or do you think that answer has to be changed to no?
We conceded for the purposes of this appeal that we were not going to challenge the jury's finding in the Court of Appeals affirmance that there was a breach of the non-compete with regard to the primary issue.
And how does that all fit in with Mr. Van Sickren's argument about 6.5?
Well, the only evidence that we submit of competition that supported the compensatory damages award was Don Anderson's engagement with Peer Pleasure. There is no evidence that Anderson Marine violated the non-compete.
Well, the second part of that question, with respect to the business non-competition provision, what does that mean?
The business non-competition, I believe that's still referring to 6.5, but just the non-compete provision.
So you're not challenging that verdict finding?
For the purposes of this appeal, we're not challenging.
Well, if you're not doing it for this appeal, yeah, you're
we're
not.
We're not challenging. Yes. But importantly, you know, the Peer Pleasure engagement, the importance of the Peer Pleasure engagement is that they use this engagement to argue that there was lost profits.
Okay. If you're challenging the amount.
Exactly.
Not the fact that the contract was violated.
If you look at the financial statements, as we argue in
talking about $15,000 or $75,000 or both?
The breach of contract damages is the $15,000 amount.
I don't think there was enough evidence for that either.
No. If you look at the financial statements that are relied on primarily by the Statsys to show lost profits, or solely relied on by the Statsys to show lost profits, and this is the analysis that the Court of Appeals takes up as well, if you look at them, and importantly, if you look at the combined sales of merchandise and labor sales, you'll see actually that the sales from 2002 to 2004, the relevant time period, increased by about 50%. If you take into account the expenses in the financial statements, you'll actually see that the profits during that period for all sales, both merchandise sales and labor sales, the profits increased by over 100%, by about 130%. So to the extent that they're relying on these financial statements, and that they simply submit them into evidence as proof of lost profits, the financial statements in and of themselves are not sufficient to prove. I see that my time is up.
Any questions of Ms. Wilden? Hearing none, we move to rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief. First, I want to address the competition issue just briefly. We put it right in our opening brief in the statement of facts. These businesses were in competition. In addition, Scott Statz testified, page 130 of the transcript, that there were overlapping product lines, including the towables or water toys and the buoys and mooring lines.
That could have been a very small percent. Was it a small percent of the total business of the new company?
If you look at the financial statements that were provided over the period of 2002 to 2004, it was about $50,000 in water toys and about $10,000 in mooring lines, buoys, that type of thing.
That was an out of how much?
Their sales were about $1 million a year for merchandise sales. But what I'm saying is there was competition, and that was a finding of fact. In fact, Donnie Anderson also testified at page 425 to 427 of the transcript for the competition that those were overlapping products.
What about with Pure Pleasure? Was that...
Yeah,
I didn't say pure, I said peer.
We joked about it that in the office. There's an old Madison business under that name. But,
yeah.
But
So with Pure Pleasure...
Yes.
With regard to overlapping product, well, I'm talking about the three franchises that were established and he consulted
right.
with and got a commission on, according to the record of her sales. Pure Pleasure, was there overlapping services?
Absolutely. It was within the 128-mile territory. In fact, the only businesses that Don Anderson set up were within the protected territory. He set up three. The commission schedule is Exhibit 3 from the trial exhibits. It shows that new sales were made by these companies of about $64,000 in that time period that Don Anderson was there and that he earned commissions. So, yeah, absolutely. And I believe that there has been concession that part could be enough to justify finding competition in this case.
Counsel, how do you know the $75,000 doesn't include the $15,000 from the breach of contract award?
Well, we were careful in terms of arguing that, and if you look at the use of the name and what we argued in terms of damages, we argued for a breach of the non-compete, and then the level of damages would be the $350,000 for the non-compete portion.
But with all due respect, the jury's instructed to listen to you, but they don't have to go by anything you say. They have to go by the evidence. And when I'm turning to the jury instructions, it seems like the breach of contract is to put you in the position you would have been had the contract been performed. And for the infringing trade name, it's a little different. It says, what sum of money will right the wrong done to the plaintiffs by the defendants? And then it goes on to give a little more information, but not a lot. Goodwill's been damaged either to general business reputation, damage to a particular product or service. Then you assess the damages you find to be shown by the evidence. So tell me what the evidence is that supports those things separately and distinctly, please.
What just supports them? I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
$75,000. What's this evidence? $15,000. How's that different from the $75,000? And how do we know the jury knew that?
Well, you ask juries to do this all the time when you have multiple claims, and the evidence that supports them are different evidence. Justice Bradley just talked about the commission evidence and the other sales for the competition portion. 64,000 in additional sales, commissions of 6,000 or so to Don Anderson. Also, the 350,000 that's directly tied to the non-compete has nothing to do with the trade name infringement. And the jury could have determined that 15,000 represented a fair approximation of those damages based on the 8 months he worked at Pure Pleasure. Trade name, on the other hand, we're talking exclusively about the value of the goodwill, the $200,000 in goodwill associated with the trade name. The jury is given this evidence and the instructions, but also the arguments aren't evidence. There's nothing to suggest there was any duplication. In fact, there really isn't an argument that there was duplication of damages. The argument is that there were no damages shown.
Could you explain exactly what the consequences would be if this court affirmed the Court of Appeals, and then the consequences if we accepted the position of your opposing counsel?
If the Court of Appeals were affirmed, then the injunction and everything would still be enforced. We'd get the $15,000 in compensatory damages for the trade name infringement. There would have to be a remand for the issue of attorney fees based on the Court of Appeals decision to determine what attorney fees are associated with the breach of the non-compete versus the trade name, because we really haven't addressed that today, but the attorney fees issue in the contract, and we would have to go into for other attorney fees as well. If you accept the defendant's argument,
there would be no hearing on compensatory damages? I mean, that's all done?
For the trade name, that was thrown out by the Court of Appeals. If you affirm the Court of Appeals, the damages were thrown out.
There's no chance to come back on that.
I believe that would be the final ruling of the appellate court.
Okay. And if we accept the arguments that we just heard from Wilden?
On the damages, that there's no damages proven? We'd still have the infringement, and we'd still be entitled to an injunctive relief. It would be an analysis of the use of the name issue, which was brought up before. I would point out to the court on this use of the name, in addition to what I've already pointed out, 6.5G of the agreement, it can't be more specific than this. It says, quote, Seller and Anderson, Seller was Don Anderson's company, Seller and Anderson covenant and represent that they have no interest in or claim to any of the, and then there's a list of items, trade secrets, trademarks, service marks, or trade names relating to any processes or procedures used by Seller or related to the Pier and Lift business. I don't know how you can get more clear than that the use of the name is separate than the trade name itself. This is the Madrigal Audio Labs case, the distinction between use of the name. I see my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank both, all the counsel, all three counsel, for their arguments in the trademark case and a breach of a contract case. And that concludes our hearing in 07AP46, D.L. Anderson Soapside Ledger Company, Inc. versus Donald Anderson. The court will take a few moments of recess to let our other students come in. Oconomowoc did not come today because there was a death in the teacher's family. So we are in recess for a few moments.